All right, the next matter on this morning's calendar is docket number 51143, Mack v. State. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor, and good morning, Your Honor, and Associate Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Mark Topel. With me at counsel table is Dan Cook. We are representing Mr. Mack under the privilege that you have granted us by allowing us to appear here pro hic vici. This case involves a very important both immediate issue for Mr. Mack and an institutional issue which you have asked us to address today on whether or not there is an obligation for this court to adopt either Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure or something similar. The immediate question of whether or not there should have been an inquiry before the plea into the issue of the applicability of lesser included offenses and whether or not those lesser included offenses would have led to or possibly could have led to a jury verdict involving a lesser sentence is something which we believe is absolutely required in this case. The defendant was charged initially with open murder. And under the laws of Nevada, open murder necessarily includes second-degree murder, necessarily includes voluntary manslaughter, necessarily includes involuntary manslaughter. That is not even disputed under the laws of this state. He pled to first-degree murder pursuant to a plea agreement. At the time he pled to first-degree murder, it is also undisputed on this record that his counsel had not discussed with him the question of at least very clearly voluntary manslaughter as a lesser included and its impact on the probability or non-probability of his being convicted of first-degree murder and or second-degree murder. At the time of his plea, he also pleaded an Alford plea to attempted murder. There is also, I believe it's undisputed, although the prosecution did not respond in its reply brief, that battery with a dangerous weapon is a lesser included in attempted murder. And the case there, of course, we cited was the Benitez case.
Do we have jurisdiction, though, to hear ineffective assistance? Are you raising ineffective assistance to counsel?
Only insofar, and that's a viable question, obviously, only insofar as it affects the voluntariness of the plea. It is absolutely the law since Park in 1991 in the U.S. Supreme Court, that voluntariness of the plea includes intelligent and knowing waiver, and that includes all necessarily a discussion of all defenses that might be available, and in this case that did not happen by counsel. So that failure acts as a negation of the voluntariness. So to the extent that that involves a failure on counsel, and counsel here is a well-known and respected counsel, that doesn't mean that he could not and did not make a mistake. I want to point to something.
Into that. My understanding, after reading and rereading, whether it be the briefs or the transcripts, is that we have a situation that the posture was that this matter had, a trial had begun, state had rested. At that point, this plea was offered, and I'm not going to get into how you're going to categorize this plea, but we had an opening statement that was offered by Mr. Mack's counsel, and that's what we have. Is the court, are his attorneys obligated to go through the theoretical concept of every defense that can be raised? Is that an obligation?
Absolutely it is.
And where do you find that?
Okay, you find it in not only in the cases that we cited from out of the district, but I would direct
a lot of your cases don't quite sit that way. That's why I asked the question.
Let me, sir, direct and in response to the question, the court. And by the way, I too join the prior case in saying it was incredibly helpful to get your questions. If you look to 174.063 of the Nevada Revised Statutes, which is the statute that sets out the requirements of the plea form that is required in cases where probation cannot be allowed, i.e. in more serious cases, it requires the following to be established. and that is that the elements of all the original charges, and I'm quoting from record at AA0100152, and by the way, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 2 minutes if I hadn't.
All right.
But I am quoting from that, and that is the plea agreement itself, which requires that all the elements of the original charges against me have been discussed with my attorney, and I understand the nature of the charges against me. That is immediately followed, Your Honor, by I understand the state would have to prove each element of the charges against me, and then it goes on to broaden that requirement to say I have discussed with my attorney any possible defenses, defense strategies, and circumstances which may be in my favor. What is missing from this, and perhaps I'm jumping ahead to comments that I would make to Your Honor's second question, is a certification of the attorney that that was done. And I liken that to the idea, if you ask somebody who had a heart surgery whether or not it was performed correctly, he doesn't know. You have to ask the doctor. And so when, and of course that didn't happen here.
Counsel, you're saying it didn't happen, and that's part of the confusion or part of the struggle for us, is that going through the hearing that you had on the to withdraw the plea and what was adduced in that record, and then the canvas of Mr. Mack, where he indicated that he had no questions and so on and so forth, to a written plea agreement with attached the various charges, the amended charges. So how do we reconcile these two different pictures in terms of what you're saying?
He can't know. Nevada requires and effectuates the voluntariness standard through 174.063. And how can he know? He's a man who has not had any criminal experience. He's a man who is not a lawyer. He is a man who has some college, but a high school. How can he know if
he's a three-year college person? He's a successful business person. So we're sitting at this objectively. How do we deal with this in the general situation of a person standing before the court?
You have to ask
these questions. How far does the court go into this?
He has to ask the lawyer. And he has to establish from the lawyer that especially where these things act as such strong defenses, involuntary manslaughter, regardless of the semantics, negates intent for murder and first-degree
Where's
murder.
The real possibilities of being found guilty of voluntary manslaughter? What does he point to?
Okay, in the record, he points to the following, that this is a this homicide arose out of a conflict between an estranged couple with a history of physical violence from the woman to the man, which was testified to at trial as well as at length in the opening statements of Mr. Friedman and I'll get to Mr. Chesnoff in a minute. And in addition to that, the pathologist testified that there was evidence that could say whether or not the wounds were on the deceased were either defensive or aggressive.
Was that enough to get an instruction on voluntary manslaughter?
Sure, because under Rosas, which is the case that controls, some evidence, however slight, entitles him to that instruction. And what was particularly troubling about the judge's findings at the end of the hearing to withdraw the plea was that the judge said, well, we weren't at that point yet when he did the plea, so we didn't even have to consider whether or not you could get the instructions on the second degree, voluntary manslaughter, second degree. Well, that is not only wrong and illogical, but it's contrary to what you have to do. When you have a plea, whether it's in the middle of the trial, as you, I believe you pointed out, or you have a plea at the beginning of the trial, everything telescopes to that point. It telescopes back to the voluntary and intelligent nature. Otherwise, think about the logic of this. Most pleas go down, at least in my experience, far and away, the vast majority of pleas go down without a trial. Does that mean that since you didn't get to choosing which theory you might want to go forward with, that you don't discuss these very, very, and I'm going to say it again, I think very powerful defenses? And in addition, in the factual record, there is the testimony of Judge Weller saying that that Darren Mack had told him that he believed that he was in fear of his wife and in physical fear of his wife. There was the testimony of a witness named Corey who witnessed the wife physically attack Darren Mack on a cruise. There was plenty of evidence here, not just slight evidence, that would have warranted, under Rose's standard, the giving of a voluntary manslaughter instruction.
What about involuntary manslaughter?
I'm sorry, sir.
What about involuntary manslaughter?
Well, I think that's a little bit further of a reach. In this case, given the standards under involuntary manslaughter, I haven't formulated.
So open murder in the state of Nevada really doesn't charge the manslaughters. In other words, you have to have some proof of the manslaughters.
You have to have some evidence of the manslaughters. It does. It technically does charge all of those. The Treadwell and I believe the Wren case in this court do say that encompassed in open murder are all the lessors. Whether or not the lessors are required to be instructed upon at the time of the jury verdict is dependent on Rosas, which teaches us that some evidence must be there, however slight is the way that it is put. But I disagree with it being slight. I mean, the classic textbook example of voluntary heat of passion negating intent murder is always usually in a relationship, almost always often in a strange relationship where there are high tempers quickly flaring between spouses who are dealing with this problem. And in addition, we have in this record, because I think the law is that you look at the totality of the record to determine whether or not a withdrawal of the plea or whether the plea was voluntary and knowing, we have Mr. Mack's testimony, in which he lays out exactly what his version was of what occurred. And we have also, at the time of the judge determining this, the clear statement by Mr. Friedman that he had not so advised Mr. Mack.
And, counsel?
Yes.
So do I understand correctly that you are asking this court to create and therefore impose a requirement that in addition to canvassing the individual who is entering the guilty plea, that we should also canvass the attorney to determine precisely what he has discussed with his client?
Yes and no. I think the attorney must be asked, as they are in federal court, have you discussed with your client all available defenses that you feel are appropriate to this case? And that's a standard that's done.
In the federal court?
In the federal court. It was not done here under the plea allocution, nor was it done in the written agreement. The
certificate. So you are asking this court to create that requirement in Nevada law?
It would be presumptuous of me to, I believe it would be a good thing, but it would be presumptuous of me to ask you to do anything. I do say that it's
failure. Also, that's what you're here for.
Well, then yes. Without any, I think that the problem here, frankly, is very straightforward. At no point under the certification of the .063 format, which was used here, or in the canvas of the lawyer, is the lawyer asked, did you explain to him, to your understanding and knowledge, all the defenses, all the circumstances favorable to him? And in fact, in this one, it even has defense strategies. That, I don't think you have to ask the attorney, what did you tell him? I mean, theoretically, these attorneys know what they're talking about.
Counsel, let me ask you this, if I could jump ahead, and maybe the chief will give you some extra time, but the timing of this whole thing bothers me. I mean, the trial, the state had rested. Would you agree that there was sufficient evidence for a reasonable jury to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt when the state rested that Mr. Mack was guilty of first-degree murder and of attempted murder of Judge Weller?
Yes, we're not arguing insufficiency of the evidence here, which is one of the reasons that I felt that and we pointed this out in our reply brief, that the prosecution's approach to this is completely beside the point. Okay. That doesn't matter. The question is was there enough evidence that that the attorney had to discuss the viability, at least the viability of voluntary manslaughter and its potential outcome?
What's the Cripps violation here by Judge Herndon that you claim?
Well, there are four instances of unrecorded discussions between the judge and counsel. The first is where the judge is encouraging the defense counsel to indicate to the prosecution whether or not there's any reality to a potential for a plea. The second one, which I think is more even more coercive in the Cripps sense, is granting the opportunity for a discussion with the family.
Well, that was his request, and it seems to me like you're looking for a Cripps violation when it appears that the judge was accommodating a request to discuss the plea with his family before they moved any further.
And we're not being perverse about it. We actually feel that logically that is sending a signal from the court that they are encouraging the plea to occur.
What are the other two prongs of your Cripps violation?
The granting of 2 days to talk at the sentencing, about granting to the defendant 2 days to talk at the sentencing, and the discussion about the Alford, allowing him not to have to talk about the Alford plea, or not have to talk about the intent.
All right, we chewed up a little bit of your rebuttal time. I will give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
I thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, and may it please the court. My name is Christopher Lawley. I'm here in my capacity as a special prosecutor for the Washoe County District Attorney's Office. The author and playwright Ayn Rand once made this observation: you can avoid reality, but you cannot avoid the consequences of avoiding reality. The reality in this case is, under any analysis of Nevada law, an extremely thorough analysis done by the district court judge, the defendant entered knowing and intelligent and voluntary pleas to murder of the first degree and to attempted murder with use of a deadly weapon. He cannot now avoid the consequences of those actions by attempting to invent a new area in Nevada jurisprudence. I would like to begin my comments today by defining very precisely the issue that is before the court this morning. And the issue is this: is it an abuse of discretion for a district court to deny a motion to withdraw a plea based solely upon the fact that a defendant was not advised by defense counsel or by the court of lesser included offenses, where the record shows conclusively that all of the factors articulated in Higbee have been satisfactorily met? In other words, is the failure to advise a defendant of lesser included offenses in and of itself sufficient basis to require that a court grant his motion to withdraw plea? I submit to you that it is not. There is no Nevada case that stands for that proposition, not a single one.
Counsel, I understand there's no Nevada case. Are there federal authorities that go that direction? As counsel is asserting, that the defendant can't make a knowing waiver if he does not know. How do you address that?
My answer to that question, respectfully, is no. There is no federal case that stands for that proposition. There is no case cited in the defendant's brief that stands for that proposition. Not one case stands for that proposition. There is no state case that stands for the proposition that the failure or the discussion of lesser included offenses is a prerequisite to a knowing and involuntary plea. They have not cited one case that stands for that position. Justice Cherry, your question to counsel was very telling, and that is, are we here on an effective assistance of counsel claim? Is that what this is? And I would note for this court, every single case cited in the defense brief, every single one of those is an effective assistance of counsel claim. Every single one of them. And as this court recognized in Arcanian versus State, claims of ineffective assistance of counsel are inappropriate for consideration during direct appeal. Moreover, every single case cited by the defense in their opening brief on this issue involves claims in addition to the failure to advise on lesser included offenses. Every single one of those cases, there was something more. There was a failure to adequately investigate various claims. There was a failure to advise defendants on the specific elements of the offenses. There were a plethora of other issues. Two of those cases, incidentally, were not even published opinions. They weren't even published opinions, and yet were cited to this court.
So let me get this straight, Mr. Lawley. You do not agree with defense counsel that if somebody pleads guilty, they can raise ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal, whereas if somebody is convicted by a jury, they cannot raise ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal?
I would disagree. This court, the precedents of this court, as recently as 2006, are very clear. Those claims are not to be addressed in direct appeal. What is also very clear is there is a long history of jurisprudence from this court, starting in Higbee as early as 1970 and cited in the same factors being cited in numerous cases thereafter, what the record must affirmatively show in order for a plea to be knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently entered. Those factors were really the hallmark of the hearing that was conducted by Judge Herndon. Did the defendant knowingly waive his privilege against self-incrimination, the right to trial by jury, the right to confront his accusers, the voluntariness of the plea? Was it the product of coercion? Did the defendant understand the consequences of his plea? Did he understand the nature of the charge, the elements of the offenses? Much of our responding brief is devoted to that, and certainly Judge Herndon found that. And I think it is certainly important to note the extreme burden that the defense faces here today. It is an extraordinarily high burden. After a district court has reviewed and determined that a plea is valid, this court presumes the district court correctly assessed the validity of the plea. It will not reverse such a finding absent a showing of abuse of discretion, the highest appellate standard there is. And that's out of Bryant, cited at 102 Nevada 272. So the question is, did Judge Herndon abuse his discretion here? And I would submit that he did not. I would also suggest to this court that the issue raised today was certainly not the focus of the issue raised before Judge Herndon. Although there are citations to the record, specifically defense counsel citing to the actual motion to withdraw plea, the issue before the court today was not addressed in that motion. There were other claims that were addressed. What I would like to do is answer the two questions posed by the court in its order of February 16th of this year. The court was concerned with two questions. Whether lesser included offenses must be factored into a defendant's knowing and voluntary guilty plea, and whether this court is obligated to adopt Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I would answer both of those questions in the negative. Under our current jurisprudence, it requires that the defendant display through the canvas an understanding of the nature of the charge and the elements of the offense. Obviously, those offenses that are squarely lesser included, unlike manslaughter, for an example. Those offenses that are clearly lesser included would necessarily be discussed. And there must, under current jurisprudence, be some showing of that. Moreover, in NRS 174.063, there is the form of written plea agreement. And one of the topics that counsel is required to discuss with a defendant are possible defenses. So when you consider these two elements of Nevada law in tandem, certainly the additional requirement, this new requirement that does not exist, to my knowledge, in any other state or in the federal purview, which I will touch upon in just a moment, it is superfluous. Justice Douglas, going back to your question, does federal law require this? My answer is no, it does not. And if you look at Rule 11, specifically at Rule 11B1, it is absolutely silent to this issue of lesser included offenses. It is not one of the enumerated topics that must be discussed.
What if we look at lesser included offenses as possible defenses? Would it be required then?
Well, it is. You are, and so, yes, it is included. Lesser included as an element of the offense. If, for instance, murder of the first degree requires a willful, deliberate, and premeditated killing, obviously, if one of those are missing, and all other factors are present, you're down to second-degree murder. And again, it's very case-specific. But this, what is so telling, when you look at the commentary, in addition, forget about the rule, because the rule is clearly silent as to lesser-included offenses.
That's why I rephrase the question based upon what's now being argued, because as I look at this, if we flip it and look at it as other possible defenses, which you can equate to, quote, lesser included, is a defendant making a knowing waiver of his rights if he doesn't understand the charges against him and what he's giving up?
My answer is no, he doesn't.
In this
case, he has to know that.
In this case, is counsel asserting these lesser included or possible defenses, whereas from your standpoint, taking the death penalty off the table, taking enhancement, the gun charge off the table, is that the balance we're looking at?
Well, I think the balance is properly and appropriately addressed under current jurisprudence, under NRS 174.03.063, and as when you look under the Higbee requirements. So I think there already is the proper balance of this issue in our jurisprudence. In trying to, after the court had sort of directed us to Rule 11, I actually was very thorough in going through the commentary to see if there were any cases, any discussion about the requirement, the need for a discussion about lesser included offenses. And there isn't. There is no requirement, not even in the commentary, that suggests that a discussion of lesser included offenses is required. The most that is said is it is advisable to do it. It is advisable to do it.
Mr. Lawley, I'm concerned, you know, being a former trial judge, yes. We're having flashbacks of how we do plea canvases, but under the written plea agreement, under voluntariness section here, it's one of the agreements Mr. Mack signed was, I have discussed with my attorney any possible defenses, defense strategies, and circumstances which might be in my favor. Is it your position that would assume maybe arguments for lesser included offenses?
Well, in this particular case, there is evidence in the record, which we've cited in our brief, that there were discussions, although I would absolutely concede trivial discussions, about manslaughter. Mm-hmm. What is important about this particular defendant is his level of sophistication and the extent to which he was actually involved in selecting the defense. He compelled his attorneys to go with the defense that they were not completely satisfied with. He made the decision. He was very involved in selecting his defense. And so in this particular case, he certainly was not only involved in understanding what some of those defenses were, but in actually, with his attorneys, selecting the particular defense that
he, now he rejected the defense that was suggested about insanity as to the shooting of Judge Weller.
That is so, well, as to the stabbing of Charlemagne, he rejected insanity there.
How about the Judge Weller shooting? Was the sanity an issue or discussed?
Yes, that is precisely correct. He elected an insanity defense as to the Weller shooting.
Okay.
You've got 50 seconds left. You want to say anything about Cripps?
There was absolutely no Cripps violation here. Each discussion about a potential negotiation was not initiated by Judge Herndon, was not sought out by Judge Herndon. What happened in Cripps was that a judge actually coerced or convinced a defendant to accept a guilty plea. That's not at all what happened here. In every instance, at the request, as my recollection serves, of defense counsel, Judge Herndon was merely advised of the progress of negotiations at various points and asked as to whether he would accommodate certain things. There is absolutely no Cripps violation in this case.
Where does it say in Cripps that you can accommodate defendants? It says you can decide whether or not you're going to file a recommendation, but it doesn't say anything about accommodating a defendant. Cripps, and I'm looking at it as a strict bright line rule, as they say.
My time has expired. May I answer the question?
I think you can answer. Yeah. I think Chief Justice will let you answer.
What Cripps says, two things. Cripps says that when the district court participates to any degree in the plea process, a judge shall ensure that such participation is placed on the record and transcribed. That is one of the two holdings of Cripps. So even within Cripps, I think, and certainly Your Honor, as a trial judge for many years in Clark County, understands that sometimes the parties request accommodations from the court. What happened in Cripps was something entirely different. There is a direct dialogue between the court and the defendant about him taking a particular plea agreement. That nothing close to that happened in this case. And I thank all of you for the opportunity to address this case. Thank you.
Justice Cherry, this case raised the issue of whether there was an adequate, voluntary, and knowing plea. That's a due process issue. The question involved is whether or not Mr. Mack was properly advised of all of his potential defenses, et cetera, as 063 requires, and all the cases that we've cited.
What about the signed plea agreement that Justice Gibbons just read to Mr. Lally?
Yes, but that doesn't have, that stands in stark contrast to the defense attorney's testimony that he didn't advise him about this, and it points out my comment earlier that you have to ask the lawyer, did you do it at the time of the plea, which was not done here, because the defendant can believe I was totally advised as far as I knew. But what does he know? And the argument that inferentially, because he was a successful businessman, and the fact that he may have known something about contract law, even though he never went to law school and didn't complete college, I have never seen in any case, in any form, anywhere, serving as a substitute for the attorney, the criminal attorney, discussing the nuanced rules that have to do with lesser-included offenses. And I think it is correct, sir, Your Honor, how you characterized our argument. Lesser-included is just a subset of potential defenses.
The one problem I do have, though, is in the plea canvas that was given, Mr. Mack did query the court on a number of occasions when the court was giving him the canvas as to things he was not comfortable with.
Yes.
And he chose not to respond as these. And the plea agreement that was offered also had, as I indicated previously, attached to it, the amended charges. And he didn't query when the court asked him, do you understand?
But it's
so
not his...
what are we to believe?
Well, you can believe what the defense attorney stated under oath at a time... may I complete my answer, sir?
Yes, you may.
Stated under oath at the time that he never advised him of these things. And you can't fill that gap in by saying that he inquired as to other things. The fact that he may have inquired as to other things doesn't substitute for the clear record that there is a lack of knowledge as to these items. May I just make one more note?
That's it. Time's up.
All right. Thank you all very much.
Counsel, thank you for your excellent briefs and the argument today. Very interesting arguments. This court will stand in recess until 11:30.